and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. It's so wonderful to have you all with us to celebrate in the traditional way of a weekly science show, which is 30 minutes of excellent science coming straight into your brain. My name is Claire, and with me this week, Lyndon, Stu, hello to you both.
Hey, Claire.
Howdy.
Howdy. Now, I'm pretty excited for this week's show because I get to hear two excellent science stories from the both of you. Lyndon, you're up first. What have you got for us this week?
You know what? This week, Claire, I actually had to, well, not farm it out, but I wanted to phone an expert. I wanted to phone a friend because I just needed to dig a little bit deeper about the dire wolves. I don't know if you saw this in the news earlier in the month.
I have.
It was on the front cover of Time magazine, these cute white wolf pups with extinct written on it, and then the extinct was crossed out because Colossal, the big scientific funding company, it's funded by philanthropy and all sorts of things, they've got lots of millions of dollars, are claiming that they have brought the dire wolf, which is a large white wolf, back to life.
Right. Okay. And when we say back to life, we mean from Game of Thrones into reality? It actually existed.
Yeah, so that's like they've buried the lead. They've discovered Westeros. And they have brought the dire wolves back.
I had honestly not heard of dire wolves before Game of Thrones, and it surprised me to find out that there used to be even bigger wolves, because wolves are scary enough as they are. There used to be bigger wolves roaming around Europe, which...
Yes,
Would want to bring those back, I have no idea, because that seems like playing with fire.
Exactly. So Colossal's whole MO is about bringing animals back from extinction. They're keen on bringing back lots of things. They've looked into bringing back the dodo. Here in Australia, they're funding the Tiger Lab, which is looking at bringing the thylacine back from extinction. And the method that this organization is exploring is finding genes that are very similar to the extinct animal and identifying those genes that can change the part of an animal that still exists to become more like an extinct animal. So the dire wolves that graced the cover of Time magazine were created from the genes of a grey wolf and then had a few tweaks made to their genes. And in the case of the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, the species that the Tiger Lab in Australia is looking at is the fat-tailed dunnart, which... is a small little amazing marsupial, but a fair stretch from the Tasmanian tiger. So I don't know much about this, but I was, you know, interested to learn more about whether this was real science or not, how close to actually bringing back these animals from extinction we are or how far away. And I know there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of discussion, and if you wanted to see scientists get really mad, Twitter and Blue Sky, when this direwolf news came out, was the place to be. So I am having a chat today with Professor Ewan Ritchie. He's a professor. Professor Ewan Ritchie is a professor of ecology and conservation at Deakin University. He works with apex predators, and I knew he'd be the person to talk to help me understand whether this is big news or not and what it can mean for conservation. So that's what I'm bringing today, and I'm really excited to have this chat because Ewan knows so much. He's great at sharing science, and he's not afraid to get in the murk, you know, of a potentially controversial topic. What about you, Stu? What are you bringing to us?
Well, you know, it's funny that you're talking about a company like Colossal who have all this money pouring out of them to do some sort of, you know, John Hammond-esque Jurassic Park work because it's really popular and cool. I'm actually going to be talking a bit about funding for science research, and sorry to have to darken our doorsteps with the specter of the United States, but A lot of research in Australia is kind of dependent on collaborations and funding from our, you know, our historical allies. But I just want to talk a little bit about what the changes in US administration mean for science research in Australia. And it's actually, it's dire like a wolf, I think. It's pretty serious, the impact it's going to have on science research and other research as well in Australia, because, you know, science is a collaborative process. It's a collaborative operation, and the less collaboration there is, the less science gets done. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about what the impact of that is going to be on us moving forward, and also a little bit about, you know, just bearing in mind that we have our own elections coming up soon, and who is in charge of our own government is also going to have an impact on that sort of thing as well. So that's something to bear in mind when you're heading towards the polls as well.
Well, there you have it. Dire wolves, and as you say, dire situations on Lost in Science this week. On with the show.
Now, I don't know, but I think people haven't pretended to be so interested in the taxation of trade routes since they were trying to convince themselves The Phantom Menace was a good movie back in 1999. I suppose we should thank George Lucas for putting the idea into kids' heads that things like trade and taxation could be important in political situations. It's still a tough sell, I've got to say.
I mean, either that or I just blocked it all out. So that movie.
That opening scroll, I couldn't recite that off by heart, whereas some of the other ones, certainly. You could even go back further in time to 1986 and thank the teacher in Ferris Bueller who's trying to get the half-asleep teens to engage with the idea of tariffs. Do you remember that scene in Ferris Bueller?
He's literally
talking about tariffs and how they didn't work in saving the economy. And the kids are all falling asleep, which obviously everyone in the audience did. Went over our heads.
Falling asleep now, though.
No, absolutely not. But look, the tariff story has caused massive fluctuations in the global stock market, started a potential global trade war, but it's not the only big economic decision that the US administration has unveiled. So under the guise of America first, in quote marks, obviously, America is not just the United States. There's a whole lot of other countries who are in America or the Americas. But America first, a number of programs sending money to other organizations outside the US have been completely cut or drastically reduced. One of the first things that was done was the membership, the United States membership and funding to the World Health Organization has been dropped, which is an amazing step in what I would consider the wrong direction. The United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, has been similarly slashed. Now, USAID programs included health programs like vaccination programs, distribution of medicine around the world, and also environmental protection programs and other projects looking at, you know, trying to protect the environment and helping people move away from environmentally destructive practices and, you know, science-y stuff, really. but even internal domestic funding is having an impact on the rest of the world. And one area that's made the news in Australia is research funding. So in a lot of news services, research funding for universities and other research institutes has been in the news. Now, as I said in the intro, science is a collaborative project, and scientists around the world benefit from each other's work and rely on each other's input and even each other's criticism to keep moving forward. This is how we generate new science, and the only thing to make science better is better science. And that collaboration is very important, an important part of it. And of course, science research costs money, although I have heard quite a lot recently people spouting the idea that science just says what the money pays for it to say. And unfortunately, that completely misunderstands how science is funded and how science research is funded. It says whatever it says, no matter who pays for it. That's how science works. That's why it's
that's how good science works.
Well, that's why it's a good way of finding things out. And if it says something that's not demonstrated by science, other scientists can just say, well, that's not true. That's wrong. We've done it ourselves and we found different. But anyway, it does cost money. Laboratories, equipment, obviously the wages of the scientists and technicians required to undertake experimentation and data analysis. But because of the universal benefit of science research, most researchers collaborate with local and international individuals and organisations to achieve their research goals. So the Australian government funds a large amount of the research that's carried out in Australia, but corporations and other governments also contribute to Australian research projects. Now, the Australian Academy of Science released a statement in March, which is a response to the US changes in funding, which states that the US is the largest single research partner for Australia and contributes the equivalent of 43% of the funding provided by the Australian government through research grants. Now, they don't provide 43% of the funding, but they provide 43% of what we provide as a nation. So they're matching 43% of what we
right.
pay, basically, is what they're saying.
So that seems like quite a lot.
It's a huge amount of money. It's a huge amount of money. Obviously, the Australian government isn't the only funder of research, but that is still, you know, that a foreign government's contributing that sort of level is a huge amount of money.
Would we be right in saying that the Australian government is the major funder of Australian research?
Yes, and also, I mean, directly, yes, because universities also provide funding for research, but they gather it from various sources. But they don't fund it themselves. The university itself doesn't fund the research. They sort of fundraise the money to do the research, more or less. But the Australian government would be the single biggest funder of research in Australia, which makes sense. They are the government. They get the benefit from it too. But in the Academy of Science statement, they also said that 40% of physical science research projects in Australia and more than a quarter of research projects in biomedical science are US-Australian collaborative projects. So a huge number of all the research in physical and biomed is collaborating with the United States and with researchers and institutes in the United States. Now, I also looked that the Australian Financial Review did a piece on this, and they estimate that US-Australian research collaborations in biomedical and clinical sciences, just biomedical and clinical sciences, amount to around $396 million in the last financial year. So that's almost $400 million in US-Australian research collabs in biomed alone. Engineering research projects were just under $60 million. Agriculture, vet and food sciences were just short of $50 million, and there's other research made up another $5 to $10 million worth of research money. Now, not all of this funding came from the US, obviously, and what did was not through a single agency. So much, although much of the medical research was jointly funded by the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, and another large portion came from the US National Institute of Health. But both of those agencies have had their funding cut dramatically since the beginning of this year, since the Trump administration took over. So the impact is already being felt in ongoing projects which evaluate existing medical interventions. For example, and this is just an example, so the effectiveness of vaccines and the risk-benefit profile of vaccines is an ongoing project. The more people get any vaccine, doesn't matter what the vaccine is, the more data you've got and the more, you know, accurate decisions you can make as far as rolling them out. Are there any groups who should be excluded? Are there any groups who should seek different types of vaccines? All of those questions, as an example of why you need big data sets and why you need collaboration, are under threat because the funding's not there, so the collaboration's not there, and we end up with less robust information to share with each other. So currently the funding of projects that are currently doing these analyses are under threat. So they're basically not able to access the funds they were using to do this work that we all rely on to make sure that we're getting the best information we can. So at the moment, sort of, there's a big question mark over where is this money going to come from? And we are talking about Australian projects. We're talking about Australian scientists working right now in projects looking at things like this kind of analysis and data collection. So another example is another department in the US experiencing cuts to their US funding, to their federal funding, such as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, which people have probably heard of. NOAA's been drastically slashed. They actually help provide some of the 4,000 ocean monitoring robots which float around in the Pacific, giving us early warnings about developing severe weather systems like, you know, cyclones and things like that, which smash against the east coast of Australia. And without that kind of early warning, we really have to, you know, rely on other sources and outdated data. So the fact that NOAA's not going to be replacing these robots, which kind of need replacing all the time because they're floating around in the ocean, they get damaged and wear out, it's going to start affecting Australian lifestyles even very quickly.
I was teaching tropical cyclones today, actually, Stu, looking at tropical cyclones. And in the practical that I normally teach, we rely heavily on archives of cyclones around the world that are stored by the US. They've got some wonderful archives and databases there. All my students trying to click on a link today, link's not there anymore.
I mean, that's the thing. Where do you start with when you start cutting funding? What do you lose first? You lose the extension, which is what that is, the public facing part of the departments and that sort of thing can easily be scrapped because, oh well, it's not going to affect the day-to-day work of the people in the department. It's just going to affect the usefulness to everyone else, which is really kind of what they're there for.
I think, as we've spoken about on the show before, a lot of the NOAA staff that have lost their jobs were people who have started relatively recently. So new blood with new ideas and newer ways of being efficient, and they were the first jobs that were on the chopping block, which is sending the organization backwards in other ways as well.
I think that's, yeah, it's often how it goes, the last in, first out kind of approach to downsizing. But, you know, again, that's it's very likely to have a higher impact on young and early career researchers and mid-career researchers rather than the established ones who are probably well entrenched in their jobs. Look, I just want to finish up by saying whether the hundreds of millions of dollars in shortfall for these kind of projects can be provided by the Australian government or by forging new partnerships in Europe and Asia to make up this shortfall remains to be seen. But these US domestic cost-cutting exercises will have immediate and long-term effects on scientific research in Australia and around the world, and possibly more importantly, direct impacts on the health and safety of people who rely on the best impartial scientific information they can get to make good decisions about health and safety and well-being. And I just wanted to finish by saying that we are coming into a federal election in Australia in May, and it's worth thinking about which candidates have these issues in mind and what are they willing to do about keeping these important projects running.
Congratulations on your discovery, which may well prove to be among the most significant in the history of science.
I cannot accept half-baked theories that sell newspapers. I'm a scientist.
Who are you? Who are so wise in the ways of science?
A most distinguished scientist whose name we know, even in the wild Transylvania.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lost in Science, half an hour of science for you. And we are thrilled to be joined now by Ewan Ritchie. Ewan is a professor of wildlife ecology and conservation at Deakin University. He also won the Eureka Prize last year for the public understanding of science. So surely he will be able to explain this situation to us in a way that makes sense. Ewan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Lyndon.
It's so great to see you and hear your voice. I've been wanting to get you on the show for a little while, and when this news came out, this big splash in the media around dire wolves, those famous white wolves from Game of Thrones have been brought back from extinction, my eyebrows were raised, and then I thought, right, I need to talk to somebody who knows a bit more about this than I do, which is why we've got you here. Please, can you explain like what this means? Has something really been brought back from extinction?
First of all, dire wolves in the true sense have definitely not been brought back. And I think that's what upset a lot of people in the scientific community. We can argue about what a dire wolf actually is, but a true dire wolf has not been brought back. And they obviously went extinct a long time ago, many thousands of years ago. I think it's about 13,000 years ago, I think was the last time dire wolves were recorded. And they were obviously spanning the North American continent as well as actually down into South America too, for about 200,000 years roughly. They no longer exist. They were about, I think about 25% or more larger than a grey wolf, but I guess there would have been overlap in some of the larger grey wolves and dire wolves in terms of their body size. The main difference between grey wolves and dire wolves is that dire wolves had much stronger jaws, much more powerful jaws, to allow them to kill and consume very large prey. And obviously we know that thousands of years ago, right around the world, there was large numbers of megafauna. They still exist in some places like Africa, but in many other continents, those megafauna are now extinct. And the dire wolf, of course, is also extinct. And so my understanding, and I'm not a geneticist, so I wanted to say that straight off the top of the bat, is that basically what's happened is that they have modified some segments of the grey wolf genome, and then they have raised embryos in a surrogate host and have produced animals that have some genetic modifications that are dire wolf-like in grey wolves. So I think a key misunderstanding often in this de-extinction topic is that people talk about cloning, and you can only clone an animal from living tissue. So people might remember Dolly the sheep. That was a clone. So you can only bring back a clone from living tissue. Of course, we don't have any living dire wolves anymore, like we don't have any living thylacines. So they won't be clones either. They will be a genetically modified fat-tailed dunart that becomes thylacine-like. How like it is a thylacine, of course, is up for debate. And there's the genetic side of it, of course, the genetic arguments. And then there's how does it behave? What's its ecology look like? So, you know, this dire wolf, inverted commas, achievement is a scientific achievement. There's no question about that. You know, there's still some fantastic science behind it. But it's fair to say that it has frustrated a lot of people for a whole range of reasons. And I personally would say that dire wolves have not been brought back yet.
It's helpful to think about it, I guess, rather than as bringing a dire wolf back. It's what Colossal have produced is a genetically modified grey wolf. Perhaps they've changed, what is it, 20 of the
that was
tens of thousands of genes? Yeah.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So a small amount of genetic information, relatively speaking, has been changed. And of course, we all know that it's complicated with animals because genes often don't operate in isolation. Understanding how all genes operate together, etc. All of those things are quite difficult to do. And I'm not questioning, of course, that they don't have a good understanding of this. I guess another tricky part is that this research is not published. So yeah. We don't actually have a peer-reviewed publication to see exactly what they've done. So we're essentially sort of, you know, seeing what they've told us, but we don't actually have a peer-reviewed publication yet. And I think that's a really important thing for people to bear in mind too, that, you know, we might put different weight depending on whether something is, a work in progress versus a published article. You know, I think they carry different scientific weight. So Yeah, it's definitely not a true direwolf. It is a genetically modified grey wolf, as many people have pointed out, and many people who are far more expert in genetics than I am.
Well, you are an expert in conservation, though, and ecology, and I want to pick up that point you said around direwolves is not just genetic. It's not just their genetics, right? It's how they live in their environment, which, of course, as you say, sort of doesn't exist anymore. And the same would be true of other de-extinction activities, bringing back the thylacine, which is a big project here in Australia. I've also heard that the colossal organization's been looking at bringing back the dodo. You know, these species that don't exist. It's interesting to think about how they would learn to exist if they had no parents to teach them. From your point of view, as a conservationist, where do you see the role of these de-extinction activities? Do you think they have their place in conservation? Or, you know, I've read lots of articles that have said, no, we should be spending this money on protecting the animals that we do have already. Do you think there's a role for this, or is it a bit too splashy to be real? Too Jurassic Park to be helpful?
Look, there's a whole range of different arguments that I think need to be discussed. First of all, in terms of the finances, I think that can be put to bed pretty easily. So people will say, if we fund research into the thylacine and try and de-extinct the thylacine, that is somehow compromising conservation because it means money is not available for something else. That assumes that it's a zero-sum game, right? It assumes that that amount of money is finite, and by spending that up, we can't spend it on conserving something else. That's just simply not true, right? There's huge amounts of money in the world, and we choose to spend that money in a whole range of ways. Ideally, we would spend a whole lot more money on conservation, and we have the capacity to do so. Many governments around the world have the capacity to do so. The Australian government chooses not to do so. They can explain why that is the case. So that argument that money for thylacine is taking money away from something else just doesn't hold. And the fact of the matter is that, companies like Colossal that are being funded by, very wealthy philanthropists, they are passionate about this topic. There's no guarantee that if they didn't spend money on trying to bring back these species, they'd spend it on something else. They may not. So, that's their personal choice. So I don't have a problem with that. I think the question about should we bring them back is a really important one, because of course in some cases the question is their environment even going to be there for them? The woolly mammoth being, I think, the classic example of that. The woolly mammoth, of course, lived in areas like the tundra, which you know very well is disappearing because of climate change. So I think there's a real ethical challenge there. Aside from the can you actually bring this back, the genetic scientific challenge of that, even if you can bring it back, is there going to be suitable habitat for that species? And if there's not, where does it live? And then, so there's a big moral and ethical question around if you can even bring them back, can you provide something that's even, remotely similar to where it once lived? And if you can't, is that an acceptable thing to do? And that then does get you, like you say, into the Jurassic Park kind of territory. Are these things just going to be novelties somewhere where people can go and see them? And is that an acceptable thing to do? That's a moral and ethical question, which again, I'm not really qualified to necessarily give a good answer to, but I think it's something that we should definitely think about. I think we should, as scientists, always be trying different things, and we learn by doing that. I'm sure when people said, we're going to go to space, people would have said, it's impossible. You can't do it. Like, you're mad. Right. And of course, people did end up going into space. And so scientists should be taking big challenges. Of course, we should always be thinking of the ethics and the morals around those decisions. But why not, do those challenges? And I think, as Professor Andy Pask and others have said, this is not just about bringing back the thylacine or other species. Along the way, they are learning things about, genetics and approaches to manipulating the genetics of species. And in some cases, that will have potential real-world benefits for living species. So, as an example, we could modify the genetic code of northern quolls or species of goannas, which eat cane toads. And when they do that, currently they die because it's toxic. You can modify their genetics in some cases, we believe. To the point that the cane toad would no longer be toxic, it'd be a tasty snack that they could eat, at nauseam. And that, of course, would be good for the wildlife because they're no longer dying. the native wildlife, but also potentially help to control numbers of cane toads. So I think, we need to be really careful when we see controversial ideas, not to, as I say, eat our own. Like, I think there's this tendency with some people to stomp on others and tread on others because they're doing something really, really ambitious. And yes, sometimes they may communicate it in a way that is not entirely accurate. But I think we should always still have an eye on the big picture about some of the benefits as well. So I think we need to weigh those things up. And I've been a little bit disappointed, I'd have to say, with some of the commentary I've seen around the direwolves and around thylacines too, that a lot of people have been, I would say, overly harsh about the projects. I'm not saying for a second that in some cases they could have been communicated, I think, more honestly and clearly. But I think we can go too far the other way sometimes. And we need to be thinking about different approaches to conservation because the fact of the matter is we have huge challenges around the world with conserving biodiversity, and we need to have all options on the table.
Yeah, it's definitely. I like your idea around thinking we were so excited about the idea about whether we could do something. We didn't stop to think about whether we should, particularly given the environments that are no longer present for many of these species that are of interest for de-extincting, which we know is not really the accurate word. But one last question for you before I let you go, Ewan, is given your extensive public communication. I know you do so many radio interviews, TV interviews, articles, lots of different things. And as you just said, there is space for a lot of miscommunication in this nuanced environment. There's a lot of experts in different fields jumping on this work as being excellent or being awful, or, there's lots of black and white where surely there should be shades of grey. But what do you think about this kind of research in terms of inspiring the next generation of scientists? Where do you think this sits?
Look, I mean, I think there's no question it gets people excited. I mean, the fact of the matter is there was a dire wolf, inverted commas, on the cover of Time magazine. How often do you see biodiversity featured in platforms like that? Not very often. So I think, again, we have to think carefully about the balance between, accuracy, and that's a really important part of science still. But we do need to motivate people to get them interested in science and to also think about solutions that we have to big challenges. Like I said, I think we always still have to emphasize the many challenges along that whole pathway in case of de-extinction. So the genetics, as I've said, is just part of it. You mentioned before, will they actually behave like, these animals? That is a big question for me as an ecologist. We have no idea how these things were supposed to behave because they're dead and they've been dead for a long time and they have literally nothing to learn from. So in the case of things like direwolves, which presumably were highly social species, because analogues like grey wolves definitely are, how will they behave? And I think another really interesting challenge too that no one I can think of has mentioned is, should you bring these animals back and release them into the wild? There is very serious concern from my behalf about their safety because trophy hunting for large animals is a big problem around the world. And can you imagine how many hunters would love to say that they were the first person to hunt and kill a direwolf?
Oh,
There
geez,
will
yeah.
be people that will say that. And the same could be said about the thylacine. So there is big questions around, is the habitat there? Will they behave even like this putative animal that we're trying to bring back? And then can you guarantee their safety? So I think, we just need to be really open and transparent about all of those things. But I do still want people to really support, science that's pushing the boundaries. Because as long as it's done in an ethical way and people can debate whether it's ethical or not, we can learn a lot. And we've seen that right across all sorts of different scientific fields. And so, I would say, and I know you would say the same thing, that there is a huge role here for really clear and effective science communication alongside the cool science.
Totally agree. Thank you so much for sharing your insights, Ewan. I know that you come at this from a caring for the whole planet point of view. So we really appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lyndon.
that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.